if you're a company that is really committed to DEI and understands that you're in that for the long term, you do the things that you need to do. And it's not performative. It is integral to the day-to-day workings of the company. And DEI was never intended to be value this over everything else. It is about being a company, being an organization, being an entity that understands that we're all in this life together, we're all in this world together, and that we have to figure out ways to interact with each other in a professional and a positive way. One of the messages that we put out at Victory is that democracy is stronger. Democracy only works when it reflects all of us, and it has to reflect the LGBTQ community. But I have never asked anyone to vote for me because I was a lesbian candidate. I have always asked people to vote for me because I was the best candidate. And that's the difference.
Have you ever noticed that some of the best ideas come from unexpected places? Your next breakthrough may come from a leader facing similar challenges, but in a completely different sector. Welcome to Chief Influencer. I'm your host, Anthony Schopp. Join us as we explore how today's successful leaders inspire, influence, and connect with others. Chief Influencer is a production of Social Driver and the Communications Board, who have teamed up to spotlight how great leaders and communicators are making their impact in the world. This episode is brought to you by the George Washington University's College of Professional Studies. With in-person and online programs, ranging from master's degrees in public relations strategy to certificate programs in digital communications, GW offers more than just the credentials to help working professionals get ahead. It prepares them to be leaders in their field. As a proud GW graduate myself, I can attest that faculty members combine academic rigor with real-world lessons that can't always be found in textbooks. Check out cps.gwu.edu for more information. I'm thrilled to introduce today's guest, Anise Parker, President and CEO of the LGBTQ Plus Victory Fund and LGBTQ Plus Victory Institute. Here are three things you should know about Anise Parker. Number one, she is the first former elected official to lead Victory. She served 6 years as mayor of Houston, following 6 years each as a Houston City Council member and city controller. She was the first openly LGBTQ mayor of a major American city. Number two, in 2010, Time Magazine named Mayor Parker one of the 100 most influential people in the world. The City Mayors Foundation named her a top U.S. mayor and the seventh ranked mayor in the world. Number three, Anise has tackled the tough issue of climate change. She was a member of President Obama's Task Force on Climate Preparedness and Resilience, was a steering committee member of the C40 Cities Climate Leadership Group, and served on the board of the Climate Disclosure Project. Mayor Parker, you've been called many things, including a visionary by Scenic Houston, guardian of the human spirit by the Holocaust Museum Houston, distinguished alumna by Rice University, and many, many more. Today, we are thrilled to call you a chief influencer. Welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be with you. And I'm sure some of my constituents had other names for me, but it's okay.
We picked all the good ones. Yeah. Well, Mayor Parker, today you run an influential nonprofit organization, and previously you ran a major American city. What's the most important thing you've learned about influencing others to make an impact?
You have to be a good listener to be a good influencer, because you have to understand what your audience experiences from what you say and what you're putting out. But you also have to understand how to reach them. And the only way I know to reach other people is to listen to what they say at multiple levels.
I think that is increasingly challenging today, figuring out how do you reach people, because the media landscape is so fragmented and, you know, there's so much noise out there. I'd love to know if you could just share some of your thoughts on the best strategies in today's sort of evolving landscape.
I don't know that you can really listen to people in an electronic world. I think you have to listen to people in person as much as you can. Now, I'd say that knowing that it was impossible for me as someone who led a city of 2.3 million people to really, you know, listen to everybody. It's also, a matter of forcing yourself out of, we're all in our own echo chambers because it makes us more comfortable. And it's easy to fall into a rut of, you know, I listen to certain information. I cannot listen to talk radio, for example. I just can't. Fortunately, I had people who worked for me who were willing to do that. I also recognize that I have to strive to put myself into places where I hear other voices. I get new inputs. I challenge myself. And I think that's the other thing that's really hard for a lot of people is, we're in our own echo chambers. We want to validate the opinions that we have. And for a lot of us, I think we've lost the will to really want to be challenged. Some of that is just as we grow older, we get set in our ways. We're comfortable with our life and our opinions. But it's always good as human beings to be open to new experiences and new ideas. It's just I wish I had a facile answer for how we do that. It's more about we have to push ourselves to be prepared to do it and to look for opportunities for more engagement.
When you were mayor of Houston, I mean, you mentioned you had 2.3 million people in who you represented, and you were noted for ways that you got out of that echo chamber, out of the office, and connected with the public. I wonder if you could talk about some of those things that you did and how effective you found that in terms of getting a finger on the pulse of what was going on.
Every month I did an active engagement to listen. And one month it would be a tele-town hall, old school. We'd do phone calls out in a recorded session. The next month it would be a web chat. We broadcast it as widely as possible, and I would take questions in real time over the internet. I would do 3 minutes with the mayor, where I would go to a library. We would announce it through the community, and I would sit there. We would book 2 hours, and it usually took me at least three to get through it. But just anybody who wanted to come in and sign up, you get 3 minutes to tell me their problems, to ask questions, anything they wanted. And then I would also do something I called market walks, where we'd go to a strip mall or a strip center and just go in all the stores. I'd talk to the sales clerks. I'd talk to people randomly shop. I would accost people shopping who just wanted me to go away. I will tell you a secret. Barbershops were gold. Barbershops were absolutely gold. The guys would love to have me come in. Beauty shops, not so much. The women are like, no. You just need to go away. Because I also had my security detail with me when I would do all of this. But in all of that effort to just hear new voices and to make sure that I got out of the City Hall bubble, I touched a fraction of the people. It was valuable because it was people I would not have heard of and from in any other way. And it gave me important insights, but I did not delude myself that I was really really talking to all of Houston. I also, on a monthly basis, one Sunday each month, I went to a different megachurch in Houston, always with an invitation, and stayed for the entire service and engaged with the congregation afterwards. Partly because we are down here in the Bible Belt. And Houston has some of the largest megachurches in the world. But that was just another venue. They were almost all Black churches, and it was important for me to get input from the larger Black community. So multiple ways, but putting myself in situations where I was out of my comfort zone and trying to put myself in communities, in neighborhoods where, again, someone could say, hey, I really have a problem with this abandoned building that's around the corner. It's a crack house. We need to do something. And they could in real time point me to where it was, and I could make notes and I could actually do something about it, which was really valuable to me.
Yeah.
And there's a ripple effect too, because I'd be in a neighborhood. Actually, I used to do this a lot when I was campaigning. It's sort of a guilty secret. Houston's 640 square miles too. It's a big sprawling city. And I preach field when I help candidates run these days. I didn't do a whole lot of field because Houston's so big, but we'd pick a precinct in the middle of other precincts, and I would go and I would work it hard, and I would knock on the doors and I would talk to everybody. And then we would leaflet the surrounding precinct saying, hey, you know, the mayor was there, or the candidate was talking to one of your neighbors. It's that just knowing that someone's willing to come to you is important.
Yeah, that, you know, when you say listening is such an important tool, some people, the way they listen might be really narrow. And giving those examples of how you're going to people, and that's one type. You probably learn different things when people come to you versus when you go to them, right?
One of the first things that any politician needs to understand is almost every governing body, certainly at the local level, all governing bodies have public session. Happy people do not come to a public session to tell you they are happy. They are home being happy. Only the angry, upset people show up at a public meeting to talk about something. And it's really easy to get sucked into the idea that those are the dominant voices out there, because they show up over and over again. And if you don't take yourself away from the chamber, from the places where, again, only the angry people show up, you don't know what the real sense of the community is. And it's, you know, the loudest voices often do get the most attention. So you have to figure out how to dial that down.
Yeah. Now, kind of switching gears to what you do now. I mean, you've been involved with the Victory Fund since its founding. Now, decades later, you are leading the Victory Fund and the Victory Institute. For folks who don't know, can you just share more about the organization's history and why the work is so important?
Victory is 33 years old, and it was founded with a singular mission, and that mission hasn't changed, and that is to put LGBT leaders into public office. At the beginning, it was solely about endorsing LGBT candidates, and they were few and far between, I will tell you. Over the years, we have also had a robust program of appointed officials as well, focused on the federal administration. But we do our work every level of the ballot, every part of the country. We're the only national organization that does down ballot races, and we don't do any policy. We just do people. We love and respect our allies, but our mission is LGBT leaders into public office, putting people into the rooms where the decisions are made about the policies that affect our lives. Other organizations can lobby the policy. We want to make sure that our democracy is fully representative of the LGBTQ community. And we have made enormous strides in that. We maintain something we call the Out for America map. And do an internet search, you can find it. And it is every known out LGBT elected official, whether we had anything to do with helping them be elected or not. There's less than 2,000. If we are whatever the percentage of the population, and the number changes every time there's a new Gallup poll, but say we're 5%, we need to elect 38,000 more people to have parity in all these elected positions. So there's a lot more work to do. And we do that work formally on the Victory Fund by endorsing people and funneling money to them. But we do it on the Victory Institute by training them to run for office, by supporting out LGBT elected officials. We do leadership programming. We connect them with each other. We do quarterly calls around different subjects so that people can get, our elected officials can be informed on issues of the day. Monkeypox, for example, when that hit, we did a convening so that everybody could hear directly from the CDC about monkeypox. All sorts of things to make sure that LGBT leaders are in office and are prepared to hold office and do the best they can for their constituents. And we don't have, we work across political divides. We're nonpartisan. We just believe that democracy is stronger when everyone's represented, and particularly when the LGBTQ plus community is under attack in so many, at so many levels and in so many venues, we have to be in those chambers.
Yeah, 100%. A lot of times you hear that phrase, if you're not at the table, you're on the menu.
Yeah, I prefer that if people aren't speaking with you, they're talking about you. Mm-hmm. And I want to be in the room where they have to speak with me.
Yeah.
Or listen to me.
When you look at
the theme. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, when you mentioned when the early days of Victory, there weren't that many candidates out there to endorse, right? It was, and now you have 2000.
In 2022, we did exactly, we had 504. The first year Victory was founded, I think they may have had six or something. It was, it's grown a lot. And I would assume, well, I know we're going to be well over 600 candidates this year.
So when you look at those candidates across the country on the map, what are the key things that you think you have done or that have happened to cause that growth? I mean, it's sort of a graph that is going up, up, up.
And it's going up very rapidly. The map grows because we elect people. We find it. We comb through. We do searches through media, looking for people who are running who identify as part of the community. We ask our current network of LGBT officials about good candidates, and we work really hard to find them and nurture them and help them be successful. But we also try to be a space that encourages closeted officials to come out. And then finally, we just find people. Our organization's been around for more than 30 years, but it is it's a big country and a big community. And because we work down ballot, there are a lot of folks who need to know about us and haven't yet. So we're constantly pushing out, we can be a support for you. We can be a help to you. We want to put you on our map, literally. And all of those methods work. The interesting one is the encouraging people to come out. It's not a big piece of our work, but in this day and age, it's still important. People will be elected and not feel comfortable at the beginning of communicating their true selves. And we help two or three elected officials a year navigate the media and the public process of coming out.
I mean, that feels like a really delicate thing to manage because folks have legitimate fears. And when you think about influence, sort of influencing someone to make a major decision like that, that is going to impact their life. That's tough. Can you talk about that? Because I would imagine you probably have some of those conversations yourself, and you know what it's like to be openly as a member of the community elected official where, you get a lot of stuff thrown at you.
Fortunately for me, I came out when I was in college. Freshman week at college, I was determined to be out. And I've been out my entire public career. But a lot of people, it's not, for some, it is in truth, they are deeply in the closet. For others, it's that they try to separate their public life and their private life. And they've never talked about their private life in any public way. The bad news in today's world is there are no private moments in public life when you're out in public. I mean, everybody you encounter has a recording device. call a telephone, but everybody has a recording device. And we are increasingly comfortable with the idea that we should know, and I don't think this is a good idea necessarily, but the idea that we should know everything about the people that we elect and that are running for office. And so we pry, we push, we want to know more. And so each politician has to navigate that. And if you have, and if you are not comfortable yet in your own skin and then trying to deal with that, it's very challenging. A great example of this, I know he won't mind sharing this, Chevron Jones, who is a state senator in Florida. He's Black. He's the son of a pastor. He was a state representative, and he wanted to be honest about his life. We worked with Chevron. It is easier if they've never lied about it, if they've simply never talked about it. But even if they've lied about, you know, their sexual orientation, we can help them figure out a way to explain why they felt it necessary to do that to their constituents, and to be open and have an open and honest dialogue, listen and communicate, and then move on. And Chev has since been elected and reelected, and he moved up to the state Senate and is becoming a power in Florida. And I think he would tell you that part of that is being able to share the love that he has for his husband, being able to be comfortable in his own skin in a way he wasn't before. He brings more energy to the work. It's very similar to the work we do. We train a lot of trans candidates. And I will tell you that while I won't say that being LGBTQ is a positive in politics, it is by no means a negative, but it is important to know how to have the conversations and to manage your narrative about something that for a lot of people is still problematic. And the best way we have seen our trans candidates deal with it is to be upfront. Danica Rome is the greatest example of that. And again, personal conversations and listening. Danica won her seat and won her seat again and won her seat again, and now has moved up to the state Senate in Virginia by knocking on doors and having front porch conversations with people who knew she was a trans woman, but were willing to listen to her ideas about how to fix the problems in the community. And people want honesty and integrity in their public officials. And, you know, some people are able to convey it when it's not there, but real integrity and real honesty is respected by folks. And that's one of the reasons that, again, there's this kind of an alchemy that goes on when someone who may be a bigot or even not a bigot, just uninformed about issues around the LGBTQ community, but it respects the fact that you are open about who you are and are willing to engage with them around it and not have a chip on your shoulder.
I love that you brought up Danica Rome. We interviewed her and featured her as a chief influencer last year, and obviously, Victory's endorsement of her and support of her has just been such an important part of her journey. She talked a little bit about owning her own story and this sort of environment that you mentioned, right? There aren't really private moments when you're a public official anymore. Right. And I think all leaders are experiencing that, whether they're an elected official, appointed official, or just somebody who runs a company or a nonprofit, that gray area between your personal brand and your professional brand has become so much more blurry. And people who, you know, whether it's your team or whether it's the public, you know, they want to get to know people personally to build trust. Trust is such an important thing that we're all looking for. And I wonder if you could sort of talk about your own experience with that, because, you know, I know that, like you said, you know, you were already out openly before you were ever elected to office, but then being in office, you certainly attracted some, folks who had, opinions and views that probably made it a little bit difficult for you to do your job. And I just wonder if you could talk about how you manage that and advice that you might have for other leaders who recognize they need to sort of maybe share their own personal story, whatever that may be. But at the same time, they're kind of worried about having to deal with that.
It is almost impossible, I think, today to have a separate private life and a public life for a public official. It's challenging for, as you said, for a business leader, anybody who's in the public eye, but for a public official, and particularly, high profile, leading a major city, or if you were in the partisan arena. And I was never in a partisan position. All my, I, you know, nine elections, I, we're all and nonpartisan, which actually, frankly, is helpful. But having a public persona that is as close as possible to the private person is important, not just for the fact that somebody's watching you all the time. It's important for the energy you bring to the work. And this is the one of the things I would say to anybody out there who is closeted. And again, everybody has to come to terms with their life in their own way. And we do not out people at all at Victory, but that there's a certain amount of energy that is involved in maintaining a facade. And when you can get through that, you can bring more of yourself to the work. And as I said earlier, people respect the fact that you are honest with them about tough things. I had a brand as mayor, and that was that I'm going to tell you what I think as directly as I can. And that brand was something that I honed over multiple elections. By the time I was elected mayor of Houston, I'd already been elected citywide in Houston six times. So Houstonian, I was a known quantity. Worldwide media attention. There's a lesbian elected mayor of Houston. Oh my God, how did this happen? Lesbian in Houston, and the two things together. But I, to Houstonians, oh yeah, that's Anise Parker. We know her. We know she's gonna tell it like it is. And I think Houstonians were a little stunned that the rest of the world was so intrigued by the fact that I was elected, because I was actually the safe choice for mayor. And I'm going to say this, and it's a little snarky, but the choice came down to, did you want the good government lesbian, or did you want the lawyer lobbyist? Oh, we want the good government lesbian, the lawyer lobbyist, because we know her. Now, anybody's in public office or in public life is going to have people who are angry with him. If I didn't have a certain percentage of Houston mad at me every day, I wasn't doing my job, because you're balancing competing interests. You're doing things. There's always something that someone's going to be unhappy with. I mean, you try to find good solutions. I some people who are in public life are always trying to have everybody love them. If you're trying to get things done in public life, you have to make sure that you have enough people who are with you to keep moving forward, but keep pushing for change. So there were always people who were angry about something. And it's very tempting to just say, oh, I don't need to listen to those. I'm going to go on a tangent here. A lot of entrepreneurs will tell you that you don't listen to the negative voices. No, you have to be aware of the negative voices, because sometimes they're right. What you have to understand is where you are right and where you are possibly wrong and where you don't know, and be open to to the input. And then sometimes people can surprise you. I had hate folks. And there is a reason that every big city mayor in America has a full-time security detail. I had death threats. But I had a guy that every Friday would show up on the steps of City Hall and precisely at noon, usually under my office window so I could hear him, he would blow a shofar. That's the long ram's horn. It's a very haunting sound. He would blow the shofar and he would call on God to strike me dead. These like clockwork, Fridays, rain or shine. One of my 3 minutes with the mayor's days, I was out in a library and the guy showed up and signed in to talk to me. He actually had his shofar under his arm. The security detail made them leave it outside because they were afraid he was going to like attack me with it. But he had his son with him and he signed up. He actually had a constituent concern that he wanted to raise. And even though it clearly found my sexual orientation and my so-called lifestyle offensive, he also recognized that I was the mayor. And it was interesting. He wanted his son to feel comfortable approaching public officials and asking questions. So there's his son. I was a little shocked because I mean, he considered me. The things he said when he was blowing his shofar and asking God to curse me were pretty rude, but that for me, it was important that I listened. I addressed his concerns. He was my constituent and I took care of the issue. It was important for me also that, you know, I don't know what messages his son was getting, kind of some mixed ones, but everybody ought to understand that here in America, you have the right to access your government. And so he was passing a vital lesson down, and I was impressed with that.
I wonder where they are now.
I don't know who he's cursing now or whether he left office so he can put his shofar down and go find something else to do. But if I had, you know, it would have been, but certainly easy to say, no, he's not allowed in here. He's dangerous. But
power of an open door.
One of the, I'll give you another interesting example. When I became mayor and for my inauguration, traditionally we have an opening prayer and a closing benediction. I asked Joel Osteen, who is a pastor here in Houston, Lakewood Church. Lakewood is maybe the largest church in America. And I asked him if he would offer a prayer for the city at my inauguration. And he agreed. And afterwards, he got ripped up by folks on the right. And I got ripped up by folks on the left for the fact that we participated in this together. And my response was actually, we didn't talk about it. We are not buddies. But our responses were remarkably similar. And that was that we live in this city together. If we want this city to work, we have to find ways to work with people that we disagree with. And the city has to come first.
Wow. I didn't know that particular story. Thank you for sharing that one. When you were arguably the most experienced mayor in the history of Houston. No one else had served on the council and as controller, but all that national and global attention that you received, like you said, everyone said, oh, lesbian mayor in Houston, that was what it was centered around. Were you able to leverage that exposure to help accomplish what you set out to do, or was it a distraction?
Oh, it was a huge benefit to the city of Houston. we on the third coast or the last coast or the left behind coast is kind of how we view it. East Coast, West Coast, people fly over and don't think about us.
I'm from Kansas City, so I relate.
So suddenly Houston was cool. And the national media paying a lot of attention. How did this happen in Houston? You know, in fact, at that time, you know, New York had never had a woman mayor. LA had never had a woman mayor. And the fact that Houston had a woman and a lesbian, you know, Fast Company magazine came in. We were, you know, the city of the year, all sorts of national attention. And it was a gold mine for the Chamber of Commerce. So we were working it like crazy. At the same time, I also, did I want to be on Undercover Boss? No, thank you.
It's hard for you to be undercover.
I think, yeah, they would have to do something. I don't know how it like look, but no, it just, that seemed frivolous. Yeah. Did I want to be on I Am Kate? No, I don't believe in reality shows. I don't like them. I did not want to do anything that would trivialize my job or the work I was doing, but I wanted to leverage every bit of national attention I had to showcase Houston. So could they come in and talk to me? Could the New York Times come in and talk to me about, you know, being the lesbian mayor? Sure. But we're going to talk about a whole lot of other things too. And I would whatever got their attention, then I would pivot away to, you know, the things about Houston and try to use it to promote the city. It was a distraction in a sense, but because I already knew who I was, I already knew the city, I'd been in office long enough to understand what an opportunity it was. We really used it, and my comms department really used it to promote the city in multiple ways. Some I did say yes to. I was on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me on NPR, which was a mixed bag because I somehow it's a 2-hour show and they distill it down, and the interview with me, somehow I managed to mention topless clubs in Houston, taking my kids through fast food restaurants in the official town car, and the weird cars we have on the road because we have the largest art car parade. My comms team was like, really? Those are the things you mentioned? Well, the conversation just flowed. I also did the Stephen Colbert show and tripped him up, which was probably one of the highlights of my life. I got him to, he gave me a softball. He kept asking, what do you call the woman, you know, is it the woman you live with? He was trying to get me to say, is she my wife or whatever? And I said, well, I call her Kathy. And he just lost it on national TV. And I'm like, yes. Oh.
That's great. No, you don't like reality shows, so we're not going to see you on Dancing with the Stars in the future, yeah, no. I guess.
No. No. But, you know, local politician Tom DeLay was on Dancing with the Stars, and I'd actually... raising money for a local charity, I did the hokey pokey with him on stage. As a public official, you have to be willing to embarrass yourself when it's embarrassing you, but not in any way bring embarrassment to what you represent in your city.
I think that's a really good lesson. And when you talk about that, you know, this drew media attention because people wanted to talk about that you were, you know, a lesbian who was elected mayor, but you found a way to select the ones that made sense and to re-pivot that, you know, conversation to the things that mattered for Houston, which made a big impact on the city, you know, being recognized by Fast Company as the coolest city and stuff like that. I mean, that makes a big impact. So I think that's a really good takeaway for other leaders to think about, how do you take those opportunities that come your way and figure out which ones you say no to and which ones you reorient toward achieving your goals?
Yeah. And it's not always easy. And, you know, my wife, we are necessarily both very much out of the closet. She jokes that we're, you know, not out of the closet. We live on the front lawn. But even so, I'm actually a pretty private person. And I, you know, sort of that same attitude is this good for me? Is this good for the city? Is this something that would be overall positive? And sometimes this is judgment calls. Sometimes you get it wrong. But going back to the theme of listening also, it's it doesn't mean that you are responding to always to what's happening around you. You also have to be looking to where you want to go. How do I get where I want to go? How do I get, what do I need for the city? What does the city need? What do I need to accomplish? What do I need to accomplish this week? What do I need to accomplish this month? What do I want to accomplish long-term in the term of office that I have? Mm-hmm. And, that two-way communication, which is vital to any public official, is also about you listening, listening to yourself, listening to, and they're good voices, they're distracting voices, they're negative voices, and finding the ones that, where it's important to listen and to lean in, and where it's to say, nope, this is what we're going to do.
Yeah. Well, I want to ask you even about that specifically, because a lot of corporate leaders, they may have, a commitment to inclusion and diversity and equity, but they're listening and they're hearing some backlash from consumers or even on corporate earnings calls or investors about this, this concern of the woke corporations. And, you work with a lot of corporations. You did as mayor, and you do in your role with Victory, because you have so many corporate partners. And I suspect you're hearing some nervousness from some of them. And they're probably wondering, well, what do I listen to that is, legit concerns that I really need to be careful? And then what is this sort of noise? I wonder if you could talk about how you would counsel leaders who are dealing with that right now.
It makes a tremendous difference whether the commitment to inclusion and diversity is a core value or it's a marketing tool or a fad of the month. And if it is a core value, it's approached differently. Being an ally of the LGBT community is not putting employees in rainbow colored t-shirts and sticking them in a pride parade. It's making sure that you have mechanisms to support your LGBT employees on a day-to-day basis, and that you invest in ways that support that commitment. And so I think a lot of companies have forgotten that rule, that it has to start. If you don't believe it, don't do it, and do it internally. A great example, and it's also what happens when Target and Target is a supporter of Victory's, and they're a good company. So what should they do when they put out pride gear in their stores and then they get attacked? Well, I would suggest that they needed to have thought through what could be the response to this and have that response in place beforehand instead of reacting in the moment. A Bud Light with the, suddenly the boycott and I can't think of the name of the influencer at the moment, Mulroney.
Mulvaney, yeah.
Mulvaney. That was a marketing effort. And it wasn't about DEI. It was about targeting a certain segment of the market. So these are we tend to put all of these things together as if they're one thing, and they're not. And so the answer is, if you're thinking of, if you're putting out a marketing push, you need to do your homework. If you are trying to like target, provide goods for people who want those goods and are willing to pay for them, you need to thoughtfully think about what the response is, because there may be a negative to that. And then if you're a company that is really committed to DEI and understands that you're in that for the long term, you do the things that you need to do. And it's not performative. It is integral to the day-to-day workings of the company. And I think we tend to conflate all of that. And there is definitely a formal and targeted right-wing push to push back on DEI. And DEI was never intended to be, you know, we always hire the minority, or we value this over everything else. It is about being a company, being an organization, being an entity that understands that we're all in this life together, we're all in this world together, and that we have to figure out ways to interact with each other in a professional and a positive way. One of the messages that we put out at Victory is that democracy is stronger. Democracy only works when it reflects all of us. Mm-hmm. And it has to reflect the LGBTQ community, but not like, I have never asked anyone to vote for me because I was a lesbian candidate. I have always asked people to vote for me because I was the best candidate. And that's the difference.
Absolutely. You know, I want to ask kind of as our closing question, you've had quite a career, and I wonder, what do you know now that you wish you knew when you were first running for office?
Well, first let me say that even though I had 9 successful citywide races in Houston, I actually lost my first 2 races.
Oh, wow.
And I ran for city council in Houston in 1991, the year Victory was founded. I was not an endorsed candidate. They weren't quite ready. And they shouldn't have endorsed me because I was going to lose. I wasn't prepared. And the second time I ran was in 1995. It was a special election, 6-week campaign. And I thought, okay, I hated campaigning. I hated losing. But I wanted the job. I wanted the work. And I could stand it for 6 weeks. I could put myself in it. And I lost. And I was, the first time I lost, I curled up in a fetal position for 4 years. The second time I lost, I curled up in a fetal position for about a year and said, I'm never going to do this again. But I realized that, you know, I wasn't running because I needed to be in office. I was running because I wanted to work on things. And the only way I could work on them, the best way I could work on them, was to be in that position. So I realized that I needed to listen to my inner voice, but I also needed to figure out what I needed to do to be a better candidate. So, you know, I wish at the beginning that I hadn't had to go through those 2 painful lessons, but what those lessons taught me was that you can, whatever job it is, you have to train yourself and prepare yourself and do what is necessary to be successful in that job. And I didn't do that for the first 2 times I was a candidate. I didn't do the things necessary to make myself a good candidate. And I really wasn't prepared had I won the job. By the time I did run and win, I had to change a lot of things about me as a candidate. I had to learn how to be a better candidate. I had to learn to listen better. But the other lesson I learned is that if you really want something, you get up as many times and you fight for it as you have to get it.
I think it's so often lost in a successful person's story when they lost, you know, when they failed at something. And obviously you build on those failures, and in the story it ends up becoming, but so many people know that you were elected mayor and that you served so long before, but I bet a lot of them don't know that you lost those two races. And when I hear that, I think, oh my gosh, to do it the third time, you know, I mean, that really takes some
doing
grit.
It the third time and doing it the same way would not have worked.
Right.
I had to, you know, the two races were fundamentally different from each other, but by the third time I ran, I was different.
Mm.
I made myself into a better candidate. I learned what I needed to do. The same kind of training that we do at Victory for our candidates every year, or with our candidate campaign trainings, we will teach you the tools of campaigning, but you have to use those tools. Yeah. And, you know, by the time, as we said, by the time I became mayor, I was the most experienced, arguably the most experienced mayor ever. And that was, it made me a better mayor because I had spent time in those other positions and I had a different view of the city, but also because that knocked me down. I got it. It took me a while. Most people who lose a political race stop. Some people lose a political race and run over and over and over again, but don't change anything. I had to stop and say, no, I'm not going to, this is what I want. What do I have to do to achieve the goal? And the education, the training, the whatever it is, if you really want it, you're going to do it.
Well, what a great story. And I know that it inspires so many others who have now been through the trainings that you offer through Victory, through the Institute. And look at that. I mean, hundreds, now up to 2,000 folks across the country. So many of them have been through your trainings or benefited from your resources. So you certainly have made a big impact.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for spending time with us today and sharing your story, Mayor Parker. Very inspiring. And I think that great reminder to everybody about listening, and it's how you listen to other people, because it's not just one way. Showing up in person is an important piece of the equation. Doing it when it's hard and you don't necessarily want to talk to those folks who are literally outside your window wishing you death. I mean, that's a pretty crazy story. And then also listening to yourself and that inner voice. And I think it's just so powerful to hear that you lost those first two races and you had to have the grit to get up and do it again, but you had to do it differently. You had to show up in a different way. It wasn't just, you know, you couldn't quit, but you also just couldn't do the same thing on repeat. So some really amazing lessons that we took away. And we're,
you know,
just so
can I say my wife and I have been together 33 years. We just had our 33rd anniversary. And one of the things that we learned very early on to say was, you know, it's not just you were right. It was you were right and I was wrong. And sometimes, you know, it's good for relationships. It's good for life. And if you're wrong, do it differently the next time.
Yeah. Oh, that second part is hard to say sometimes, but you're right. It makes a big difference. Mm-hmm. Mayor Parker, thank you so much for being with us, and congratulations on adding chief influencer to a list of many, many wonderful accolades. We're really proud to have you on here.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of Chief Influencer, a production of Social Driver and the Communications Board. If you know a leader who should be featured as a chief influencer, please nominate them at chiefinfluencer.org. For show notes and more, visit us at chiefinfluencer.org or follow Chief Influencer on LinkedIn. Until next time.